And as always, the main reason for the no without further ado is that this is the only thing separating us from cocktail hour. So we're going to be very, very brief about this. Thanks for that introduction. I've given the closing keynote here for I forget how many years in a row, and I've realized it's actually one of my favorite talks to give every year. And I was thinking about why that is, and it occurred to me that this is basically a no-pressure TED talk. Because you've got to deliver, you've got a short amount of time. TED Talks are pretty quick, so this is going to be quick. You've got to get a point across. This is a talk about ideas, which is fantastic. But if you don't nail it, in sharp contrast to TED, if you don't nail it right here, right now, it's not a career-ending failure in the eyes of the entire world. And you can recover from not crushing this. I don't want to use that as an excuse, though, in case this does happen to suck. I want to talk about what one really simple idea here at the end of the day, which is the conclusion that we've come to at our initiative on the digital economy. After being immersed in this wave of digital innovation that's been unfolding for the past few years, and the wave, as I look at it, is not anywhere near cresting. It's still just gathering momentum. So the idea that I want to try to leave you with today is this notion that as we look into the future and we think about the continuation of the science fiction technologies, you know, self-driving cars and super intelligent machines and all these things, we think about how far away or how close those breakthroughs are. The message that I want to leave you with and the conclusion that I've come to after looking around for a while, these things are going to come more quickly than we believe they are. Objects in the future really are a lot closer than they appear. And to make that concrete, I want to take you on a whirlwind tour, not of the past decade, not of the past 20 years of digital innovations. Let's just look at what's happened over the past 5 years and some of the breakthroughs we've seen in that time. My first what on earth is going on moment really happened about 5 years ago when I read that. Can I get my slides, please? When I read that Google had been building and driving completely autonomous cars on American roads in traffic without mishap. And I love the fact that they announced this in a blog post. It's this, oh yeah, by the way, we've built the Jetson car, this completely futuristic thing. We're doing that. And they just announced earlier this year that they have in fact had 11 accidents with their autonomous fleet of vehicles in about the 1.7 million miles that they've driven. I think 7 times they got rear-ended by somebody else, 3 times somebody sideswiped them, and 1 time somebody made a lane change and ran into the car. In other words, 0 out of 11 times was it the car's fault. This is an absolute science fiction technology. We used to think of a completely autonomous car as exhibit A of something that would not happen because the task was so difficult. So I read this, and you heard from my co-author, Eric Brynjolfsson, earlier today. He and I could not believe what we were reading here. We called in all of our favors at Google. We finally got a ride in their completely autonomous car. And the reason we're grinning like idiots in this picture is we survived a trip in a completely autonomous car. What I took away from that is that when you're a passenger for the first time in one of these vehicles, you go from abject terror, because when they take their hands off the controls and the car starts driving itself down the highway, that's a high stakes experience. You go from abject terror to passionate interest to boredom in about the space of 10 minutes. By the end of this ride, I couldn't wait for it to end. It had that same level of visceral thrill as the monorail that takes you from your gate to the terminal at a lot of airports. The car is just that exciting. It doesn't speed. It doesn't weave in and out. It's not opportunistic. It doesn't have a middle finger. It just goes down the road, obeying the laws and keeping you safe. It was pretty unbelievable. So in 2010, I started to get this idea that something is fundamentally different now. That impression was reinforced the next year in 2011 when we had that fantastic head-to-head competition between two of the best all-time human Jeopardy players and Watson, the computer built by IBM. Stupid question time. How many of us here have played Jeopardy? sat at home and watched Jeopardy. Everybody, right. And we think it's the same thing, right? We sit at home on our couches and we all say the same thing, which is, I could beat that guy, this isn't that hard. Deep down, we know that Jeopardy actually is pretty difficult to play well, but don't take my word for it. We're gonna play some Jeopardy. And we're not gonna play one whole round because happy hour is really close at hand. And I didn't have buzzers to hand out to everybody. So we're gonna do a very lightning round version of Jeopardy, but we're gonna try to be as faithful as possible to the way the show is run. So I'm gonna flash up the question. I'm going to read it in my best Alex Trebek imitation. When I'm done, not before, when I'm done, if you know it, shout out the answer. And if you wanna be really Jeopardy cool, phrase it in the form of a question, okay? William Wilkinson's An Account of the Principalities of Wallachia and Moldavia inspired this author's most famous novel, Go. Boo, 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 boo. All right, we don't appear to have any threats to Watson here in the room. Once in a while, when I ask this question, there'll be a big enough 19th century English literature nerd in the audience, and they'll shout out, what is Dracula? Which is absolutely correct. And dead flat wrong. Because if you unpack this question, you'll find out they're asking you for the author, not the book. So you gotta know a lot, you gotta unpack the question, you gotta be fast on your feet. This is a really hard game to play well. Watson is the guy in the middle there. Watson went up against Ken Jennings on the left, who became an American folk hero when he won Jeopardy 73 times in a row. Most of us watching were convinced that he was genetically engineered, raised from birth by ninjas, only to play the game of Jeopardy. The guy on the right is Brad Rutter, the only person that ever beat Ken Jennings, beat him twice. These guys were really, really good Jeopardy players. Another way to think about it, these were the two best knowledge workers in this particular weird little industry. They went up against Watson, and honestly, it was not even close. So over the course of 3 days, Watson took home more than three times as much money as either of the two human competitors. And it was just like, it was watching technology just steamroll humanity in a game that we invented ourselves to show off human ability. It was deeply impressive. It also yielded my favorite evidence, my favorite data about what's going on in the second machine age. And we got this data from IBM about how to play the game of Jeopardy well. So each of these dots is a human Jeopardy champion. And you notice how they're all clustered up to the top? That's because the vertical axis here is accuracy. You cannot win on Jeopardy and get a lot of questions wrong. So those are human champions, the gray dots. The red dots are Ken Jennings. And you notice, even in comparison to other champions, he was really literally in territory of his own. He was farther over to the right. The horizontal axis here is aggression. How often did you try to win the right to answer the question? And everybody wants to be up and to the right. You see how Ken Jennings just carved that territory out for himself. So that's humanity. Here's technology in November of 2006. And you notice two things at that point in time. First of all, you notice that Watson is a line instead of a point. That's because the IBM team could tune Watson to be more accurate or more aggressive. So he's got a frontier instead of just a point. The second thing you notice is that Watson sucks in December of 2006. Any of us could have crushed Watson in December of 2006. It didn't know anything, it gave nonsense answers. It was just like a random answer generator. It was a terrible Jeopardy competitor. And then to me, what's interesting is that you can watch, not even year by year, but month by month, you can watch Watson get better. And you can see how quickly it starts to encroach into that human territory, that human champion territory, to the point that when we have our last line up here in November of 2010, that's less than 4 years from the start. In November of 2010, Watson was clearly in human champion territory. Doesn't quite look like it could beat Ken Jennings on a good day, who the heck knows? But we know how it turned out. Watson crushed the two best human knowledge workers in this domain. And Ken, to his everlasting credit, Ken had a wonderful postscript to his experience. When he gave his final Jeopardy answer, and he got it right, he knew that it was actually Bram Stoker, he said, I for one welcome our new computer overlords. And he wrote about this later. He said, look, in my weird little industry, the torch has been passed from digital superior, from human superiority to digital superiority. He said, I don't think mine is the last industry where that's going to be the case. The next year, in 2012, Google announced a pretty serious breakthrough. They realized, they announced to all of us that there are cats on the internet. That's the unimpressive way to talk about this initiative. The impressive way is to accurately describe it. They took $1 million of pretty cutting-edge hardware. They put a state-of-the-art machine learning technology on top of that hardware. And what they then did was give it a bunch of YouTube videos. And they said to this system, with no training, no preparation, no advance warning, basically, they said to the system, you tell us what you see in this massive information. We're not going to tell you what a cat is or what it might look like or anything else about this body of information. You tell us what the themes or the motifs are that you see here. And the system went away for a while, and it came back and said, there appear to be these things, they have this symmetry, they crop up fairly often. Let's call them faces. Those faces sit on top of things that look kind of like this overall. We're going to call those bodies. And sure enough, there are these weird, small, fluffy things that the faces seem to like a lot. We're going to call those cats. In other words, this is a pretty good example of, what do you want to call it? Induction, inference, reasoning upward, abstracting reasoning. This is stuff that all of us are very, very good at. And technology has historically been terrible at. That's just not true anymore. Our technologies are getting pretty good at that style. The very next year, Andrew Ng, who's a rock star artificial intelligence machine learning researcher at Stanford, at Google, now at Baidu, the Chinese search engine, he wanted to see if he could replicate those same results on a cheaper hardware platform. He realized that not everybody has $1 million of hardware budget to play with. So he said, let me see what I can do to replicate those results. And he grabbed a bunch of graphics processing units, exact same ones that are in Xboxes and gaming consoles. And he built a system 1 year later that reached the same level of performance. He spent $20,000 on the hardware. So that's a cost improvement of about 50-fold in 1 year. That makes Moore's Law look like child's play. And very, very little makes Moore's Law look like child's play. In 2014, Microsoft announced that with Skype, not only could you make free calls to people around the world, you could make free calls to people around the world with whom you did not share a language. So at least among English, Spanish, and Chinese now, Skype offers nearly instantaneous translation among those three languages. This is an absolute Star Trek technology, and it's not perfect, but it does something like work. It absolutely delivers. Also in 2014, at least one venture capital firm gave a vote to an algorithm. They said, we are absolutely going to rely on technology, on technology's opinion about this company, about this sector, about whatever. We're going to have our algorithm give us a vote. We're going to take that into account when we're making our investment decisions. And, you know, scanning the environment and figuring out the next great investment opportunity, I used to think of that as a uniquely human activity, and it still is, but I think it can be reinforced a great deal by technology. So far this year, in 2015, we've seen a couple really good examples, again, of technologies learning to play games at a very, very high level. And games are interesting because we didn't build them for technology. We built them to test our own minds, and they have very clear outcomes, so you know how well you're doing at them. A group of fiendish geniuses in the UK earlier this year published the results of a study where they built a cutting-edge machine learning system, and they pointed it at some of the classic Atari video games of the 1980s. How many of us recognize this one? This was an epically cool game, right? This was Battlezone. This could not have been bigger. They pointed this technology at Battlezone, Space Invaders, Pong, Breakout, Centipede, a lot of games that a lot of us have spent many quarters on. And they said, and actually they didn't say to the system, here's how to play the game. Here's what the game is about. So they didn't say, you are a tank commander in Battlezone and your job is to fight the other tanks that you see. They communicated none of that. They didn't try to communicate what good strategies would be here. They didn't even tell the system what the controller did. This is how you turn left. This is how you turn right. All they did was say, You see that big number in the upper right-hand corner called the score? Your job is to maximize the score. You figure it out. That system is now the world's best battle zone player. You will never, ever take a point from it in Pong. It will never, ever miss the ball in Breakout. And it's a really, really good Space Invaders player, too. They pointed it at 50 games, and about 30 of them, the system pretty quickly demonstrated superhuman performance. So this is a combination of what they would call deep learning and reinforcement learning. This is a technology learning how to go after a goal entirely on its own and doing a pretty good job on it. Also in 2015, how many poker players are in the room? Okay, do not play poker against this technology. It's a deeply bad idea. There's a flavor of poker, it's two-person, that's called heads up, and the betting is fixed in advance. You can only bet $10, say. That's called limit, heads up. Texas Hold'em is the variety of poker. When you put that together, this team built a system to play heads up, no limit, heads up, hold'em, and it's better over the long run. It's gonna be better than any human being out there. The last little wrinkle here that I find fascinating, though, is there's another variety of that same game, two-person hold'em, where the bets are not fixed. You can bet any amount. That's called no-limit poker. It is an unbelievably more difficult game than playing limit poker. The possibilities multiply. There are more possible no-limit heads-up hold'em games by far than there are atoms in the universe. And when the game blows up this heavily and into this many possibilities, the fascinating thing to me, we humans still hold the edge. This is a screen grab of a contest that ended earlier this month where four of the all-time best human poker players went up against a system built out of Carnegie Mellon called Cladico, and you'll see in three of the four cases, at the end of 80,000 hands of poker over the space of about 3 weeks, three of the four human beings had a positive balance against the same technology. Only one guy was getting left behind. And this indicates to me that we're not at the point where the technology is going to steamroll over everything that we can do and everything our minds are good at. This weird computer between our ears still adds a lot of value out there in the world, out there in the economy, particularly in weird, uncertain, these situations where there are so many possibilities that brute force calculation won't carry the day for you. That's where we shine, even in comparison to these amazing technologies that we have now. So the future for me is not going to be a completely automated technology, and the goal is not to get all of this bad human labor out of the way as soon as possible. The real goal, the real profits are going to come when we work more deeply to figure out what it is that we're good at, what are our minds and bodies really, really good at, our comparative advantage, and how do we combine that with these amazing capabilities that technology is demonstrating so quickly. You just heard from my colleague George Westerman. Earlier today, you heard from Eric Brynjolfsson. I think you've met David Verrill earlier today. We're part of the team at the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy. Our job is to try to figure out, try to understand more deeply these extremely thorny questions, such as how do we bring together in the business world the minds and the machines to create a huge amount of value, because there is going to be a huge amount of value created in the second machine age. The race is on for who's going to get there first. Let's have a drink. Thanks very much.